Sasarasanamujjamya
Mrigayurvanaguchara Hancha sadur mrigandena Venusavicharujanaha Saha. That boy of the name Vena. Sarasanam. His bow. Ujamya. Taking up. Mrigayu. The hunter. Vanaguchara. Going into the forest. Hanti. Used to kill. Asadu. Being very cruel. Mrigan. Deer. Dina. Poor. Vena. Vena. Asu. There he is. Iti. Thus. Arad. Would cry. Janaha, all the people. Translation. After fixing his bow and arrow, the cruel boy used to go to the forest and unnecessarily kill innocent deer. And as soon as he came, all the people would cry, "Here comes cruel Vena. Here comes cruel Vena." Purport. Kshatriyas are allowed to hunt in the forest for the purpose of learning the killing art. Not to kill animals for eating or for any other purpose, the Kshatriya kings were sometimes expected to cut off the head of a culprit in the state. For this reason, the Kshatriyas were allowed to hunt in the forest. Because this son of King Anga, Vena, was born of a bad mother, he was very cruel, and he used to go to the forest and unnecessarily kill the animals. Although the neighboring inhabitants would be frightened by his presence, and they would call, "Here comes Vena, here comes Vena." So from the beginning of his life, he was fearful to the citizens. Here's a description of how a very powerful prince became degraded, how he became sinful, how he became very cruel. So he was highly unqualified as a king, because kshatriya means kshat, means pain, and trayate means he who delivers others from pain. So this is the nature of the kshatriya. A kshatriya, or a ruling king, in the Vedic culture was meant to alleviate the suffering of mankind. And his whole life was dedicated to that principle. So, not a ruler who was hungry for power, who was overwhelmed by greed, and who, in the cause of enjoying his own power, became cruel. But Vena was an unqualified ruler, an unqualified king, who was extraordinarily cruel. One bewildering point that is being brought up here is that in general such kshatriyas who were meant to alleviate the world from suffering were engaging in killing animals in the forest. They were engaging in hunting. So that always is a difficult point to understand, because why would they cause suffering to the animals? It is, however, said that because the kshatriyas, they had to also be able to kill any opposing people who were criminal. Therefore, they also practiced the art of killing. And in dealing with wild animals. They would learn to kill and hunt. Kshatriyas were protecting all the residents of the forest. In Vedic culture, many different classes of men were staying in the forest. Many sages were residing in the forest. Many brahmacharis were staying in ashrams in the forest. Many renunciants were residing in the forest. And the kings would also come to the forest and hunt wild animals to protect those who were residents in the forest so that they could be peaceful there. The system of Varna Ashram is a system where society is divided in four classes. Chatur Vidha Bhajante Mam. Four types of people worship the Lord. Chatur Varnan Maya Sristam. Four types of Varnas and Ashrams are created by the Supreme Lord. The Brahmanas, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas and the Sudras. Mukha Bahura Pada Ja. The Brahmanas represent the mouth of the Lord. The Kshatriyas, the arms of the Lord. The Vaishyas, the waist of the Lord. And the Sudras, the legs of the Lord. The Brahmanas are meant to speak on behalf of the Lord. The Kshatriyas are meant to establish the principles of Dharma by means of ruling. And the Vaishyas, they are meant to generate resources for society. And Sudras are meant to serve the other classes. So this system of Varnashram is the social system. Without a social system, it will be very difficult to practice a spiritual tradition. A spiritual tradition needs a social situation as its support. And therefore, we are discussing Varnashram. Varnashram, or the Vedic political system, where different castes were existing. By the way, initially not hereditary, but Yasya laksanam proktam pumsavanabhiv janjakam yadan yatrapi dristyeta tatte naiva vinaya, they said. Rather, by qualification, by the qualities of one's work, one was classified as belonging to a certain caste, not by birth. Later, it became by birth. And once a particular social position was claimed by birth, it became an oppressive system, which led to the downfall of Vedic culture in India. But when Vedic culture was flourishing, people were just engaged in activities according to their inclination, as different people will have different inclinations. There will always be those who will be intellectually inclined, those who will be inclined towards organization and administration, who feel they have to do something about things. When things are getting out of hand, they feel they have to stand up and do something about it. Then there are always those who will see profit and who are inclined towards economic gain. And there are always those who by nature are inclined to work with their hands and who may not be so intellectual. These classes of people exist at all times. So society is being regulated. The whole purpose of Vedic society is spiritual. The whole idea is to make that everyone in society can make spiritual advancement a priority. So that is a healthy society. Nowadays, we don't have a healthy society. We don't have a society where spiritual life is in the foreground. Rather, nowadays, it is economic development that is in the forefront of society. And then everything else is secondary. So First, economic well-being, and then spiritual life has become a luxury. And some people may be very much into that still, but that's exceptional, and society is not supporting it. In the Vedic times, if someone was inclined to being a Brahmana and was inclined towards studying the scriptures and dedicating his life to following the scriptures and was prepared to live a simple and austere life, people would maintain him. The other people would simply maintain him by donations. There was no need for someone like that to work. But now in modern times, it's the opposite. One has to work all day and practically very little energy and time left for spiritual life. So therefore, Vedic culture is in principle a positive culture supporting spiritual life. Spiritual life is the essence, and that is our true objective in life. There is no need to really do much else. There is no need to make complex material arrangements. One principle of spiritual life is that one should learn to satisfy his material needs in the most simple possible way. And one principle is that if one is able to minimize his material needs, that simultaneously he can increase his involvement in spiritual activity. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada coined that phrase, simple living and high thinking. That is our objective. And the entire system of Varna Ashram, we spoke now about the four Varnas, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Sudra, and also the four Ashrams are there. The sannyasis, the vanaprastas, grihastas, and brahmacharis, also coming from the mouth, the hands, the waist, and the legs of the Lord. So the sannyasi represents the head of society. He is meant to give the vision. He is meant to give a sense of direction. And he is meant to speak. He is meant to point towards pure devotional service. The vanaprastha is representing the arms of Vedic culture. He is meant to sacrifice material comfort for the sake of spiritual advancement. And he is meant to put material advancement as a priority. Grihastha, the waist, is basically living in the world and is meant to generate money through pious means. Somehow or other, if the grihastha is maintaining proper standards of religion, then he understands what to do and what not to do. Then he will not become involved in destructive activity, or described in scriptures as ugra karma. Ugra karma is destructive work. Nowadays, there's plenty of that. Our whole society is basically a destructive society. We are destroying the planet. We are doing so many destructive things in our way of life. Vedic culture is very carefully avoiding that. So grihasthas are allowed to maintain families, to engage in economic development, but must avoid a destructive lifestyle. the sudras, the brahmacharis. The brahmacharis are the legs in Vedic culture. The brahmacharis are meant to work very actively in spiritual life. They study Vedic scripture. They realize that they are not the body, that they are eternal spirit soul, and therefore they are not very interested in pursuing the interests of the body. They learn to minimize them. No? But at the same time, they are very active in preaching, in assisting superior devotees. So we are amongst Vaishnavas. We are again reinstituting elements of Varnashram. Not rigidly, but we, to some extent, we need these social arrangements in place. We also follow the same principle, again, to materially live as simple as possible. As simple as is practical. It's not that we have to force ourselves into a simple lifestyle at any cost and with great difficulty try and live as simple as possible. But still, as a guiding principle, simplicity is important because we need to procure time and energy for spiritual life. Modern society doesn't allow it. It allows a certain a standard of comfort and facility. But if one has everything that people have in the world, then generally speaking, we have no time. No time left for spiritual life. So Prabhupada makes that point, that the devotee should be ready to live on a simpler standard of life than the general populace. This human life is particularly meant for spiritual life. Atatu Brahma Yigyasa, Vedanta Sutra. Now that we have attained this human form of life, let us inquire into the absolute truth. Otherwise, one can understand that life is not successful. Parabhavas, yigyasitu atmatattvam. That anyone who is not inquiring into the absolute truth, he is defeated. He is defeated by the material energy. So, the material energy is offering us opposition. We have to struggle to attain our goals. It is, in a sense, life is not just a holiday cruise. Life is, in so many ways, a struggle, a battle. That battle is not the struggle for material survival. Rather, it is the struggle for spiritual development. And that is the fundamental mistake. People get involved in a struggle for material survival, somehow or other. But that we cannot make our main objective. It means that one must be ready to accept one's karma. Srila Prabhupada points out that by karma, everyone has a natural material status and a natural material level. So if we can just be satisfied with what comes of a reasonable amount of work, then it's fine. But when we want to have more than what comes from a reasonable amount of work, then we start to endeavor very, very much. We work far too much to get more material development. So this is actually a mistake. One should just work a minimum amount of time and then be satisfied with whatever comes in return from that. That is what is recommended. Unlike modern society. Because the human form of life is really meant for spiritual purposes, for developing attachment to Krishna, for becoming free from our lower nature, becoming free from the influence of lust, greed, and anger, envy, madness, illusion, to come to the point where we are minimizing our bodily needs so far that we are practically 100% engaged in the service of the Lord. We see Chakcha Purnam Asi Samanla Patisrenim Sada Tuchavat. We see how these six Goswamis, they were such extraordinary devotees. Because the six Goswamis, they were extraordinarily wealthy and powerful before they became Goswamis. They were ministers. Sanatan Goswami, the Prime Minister. Rupa Goswami was the Minister of Finance. And naturally, they were accruing plenty of wealth. But it said, Chaktaturnam Asisamandala Patishrenim Sadatuchavat. They voluntarily gave up that wealth. And they lived very, very simple. They went to Vrindavan. And in Vrindavan, they would not have a fixed residence. They would stay under a tree, a different tree, every night. They would gradually minimize their eating and their sleeping to a point where they hardly slept and they hardly ate, and they were always absorbed in remembering Krishna. Not to be imitated, not to be enforced, not that we are meant to force ourselves into such a state of renunciation, but something to be considered, that they increased their worship of Krishna and that they simplified their material needs, and eventually the worship of Krishna became so deep and so inspiring that on the strength of that inspiration they could leave all material entanglements and satisfy their material needs in the most simple way. So this is the idea. Initially, we keep our material arrangements relatively simple. Then we begin to deepen our devotional practices. We take up devotional service. We adopt principles of purity in our life. We render selfless service to Krishna. We go deeper and deeper into hearing and remembering about Krishna. And in this way, our whole life begins to center around Krishna. Then gradually we can develop spiritual advancement, develop a higher taste, a taste, so much taste for serving Krishna that we can minimize our involvement with the material energy without any difficulty. Rather, it comes automatically. We don't want to bother anymore. We just say, why bother with all these things? I mean, no time. Just like Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was so eager to chant many rounds while he lived in a simple hut, that once when the roof was leaking in the rainy season, he just held up an umbrella over his head, rather than fix the roof. He didn't want to take time out from his chanting. Again, not to be imitated, but we can see that at one point the taste has evolved so much that a devotee really doesn't want to do anything else but chanting 24 hours a day. At that stage, arrangements of Varnashram also become less and less important. As one becomes more and more spiritually advanced, one needs less and less of a social support structure. But as we are not so advanced, and as we are still quite dependent on material arrangements, then Varnashram is also more important to us, and we need to make it a point to take shelter of it. In this way, Varna Ashram offers us a basis, a culture, a way of life. Because in Varna Ashram, there is always prescribed duty. Everything must be done according to scripture. So in Varna Ashram, there is some scriptural guidelines. And because there are scriptural guidelines for one's lifestyle, then one becomes purified. Maybe my final point is, we see here in this narration about Vena, we see how Vena, although he was born in a Vedic culture, a culture which was based on spiritual principles, he didn't fit. He wasn't able to fit in society. In other words, there was always human nature. There was always human nature, and human nature was sometimes in conflict with the system of prescribed behavior. Now that's a very relevant consideration for us, because we also find that inner conflict in ourselves between our human nature and the system of prescribed duties and principles of Varnashram. We may find that that's very difficult to rhyme these two. So in regards to human nature, we have to understand that our human nature at present is a temporary thing. It's not who we really are. And that is important to understand. We are of a particular nature due to the interaction with the material energy. We have developed a certain nature. It's not that that's us. Our character, the character that we've had since we were a child, that's not necessarily our personality, our true personality. Rather, that is a covering. It is said that the wind, as it is blowing over the land, carries the aromas of where it's blowing over. If a wind blows over a garden of roses, smells like roses. If the wind blows over the sewage, it smells like sewage. If the wind comes from the sea, it smells like the sea. So the wind has different scents. But the wind itself is not like that. It just picks up these scents from the areas that it crosses over. In the same way, the living being picks up certain characteristics from situations in life. Life after life. And this is the second nature. So right now, what we think is our character is actually our second nature. It is not our true self. In a process of purification, in devotional service, our true self becomes gradually uncovered. And therefore it is said that as one begins to know Krishna, one also begins to know oneself. So is stated in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Just, and the analogy is given, that one cannot not see himself without the light of the sun. Right? If there's no light, we cannot see himself. In the same way, one cannot know himself without having a relationship with Krishna. So in the relationship with Krishna, gradually our true nature, our true character becomes manifest. This is sometimes known as the higher nature. So this true nature, higher nature, is who we really are. The lower nature is the temporary character that we have developed by interacting with the material energy. So now, by a process of purification, our temporary nature or character is going to change. And this is the amazing thing. So our temporary character can change. It can change. And devotional service is a process which can change that temporary character. So we must be prepared to cooperate with that change. Not that we are very fixed in our ways and say, well, this is the way I am and I cannot change. You know, this tendency is very strong in everyone. This is how I am, and well, that's just how I am. And there's nothing I can do about it. I know myself. I've always been like this. Right? And this is the illusory energy. Devotional service has the power to change that temporary nature and temporary character and lift us up and bring out a deeper nature. In other words, we can change. In other words, we must change. In other words, we must be open to change. And we must accept that I can change and not think, oh no, I cannot change. I will never change. It is not possible. I am the one I am. Because if we have the last attitude, yeah, then we're holding back. Then we are blocking the change, obviously. And many of us, we are doing that. All of us, I could say, we are doing that. We are blocking our own progress by stubbornly holding on to our conditioned, external, lower nature. So, and we think, no, I cannot be free from lust. This lust has been with me so long. I know myself. Maybe I need to be very careful. I cannot just give up this lust because I know myself. It will come back. No, still, we can give up lust. In the service of Krishna, lust will disappear altogether. Anger can be conquered. It will disappear. Greed can be conquered. It will disappear. All the features that belong to our conditioned character, all our weaknesses, can be overcome. And we can actually make it to become perfect, transcendental devotees. And so in the process of Krishna consciousness, we must have eagerness and willingness to change ourselves. When we are working in this process of devotional service, the only obstacle that we are facing is ourselves. We are the only obstacle. There is no other obstacle in devotional service. It's us. We are the obstacle. Otherwise, there is no obstacle. Yeah. So, therefore, spiritual life means that we must be prepared to change. Otherwise, it will not be possible. Okay. With that, I will stop. Any questions, any comments? Yes?
You mentioned about the materialistic people of the Kanda. I'm just curious, Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita say that he covers the covers in the yoga maya. Is there any reason why he used the word yoga maya, not maha maya?
Nam prakasa sarvasa yoga maya samavrita. It is said that those who are materialistic and who are not interested in Krishna, that Krishna covers such people. And he uses the term yoga maya. Generally speaking, when maya, the illusory energy of Krishna, which covers the living being, is described, it is divided in two categories. One is Mahamaya and the other one is Yoga Maya. The external energy, Mahamaya, is generally referred to as the energy that covers the materialists. And generally the term Yoga Maya is a specific type of illusion which Krishna sometimes employs to cover his devotees. So why in Bhagavad Gita would this term yoga maya be used for the covering of the materialists? It looks like a wrong use of the term. Of course, when Krishna is speaking, we must appreciate that Krishna is beyond mistakes, and therefore that it cannot be that it was a little philosophical slip which is bound to happen to human beings, but can't happen to Krishna. So when Krishna explains yoga maya, we must take it that Krishna was speaking from the spiritual platform, and that Krishna ultimately sees that all maya, all illusory energy, is coming from him, and that therefore it is all yoga maya. Just like Srila Prabhupada pointed out that in a discussion with Allen Ginsberg, Allen Ginsberg was speaking about many world religions that don't accept a deity form. He said because the principle that Allen Ginsberg brought up was a deity of God, right, can never represent God, because how can spirit be captured in matter, was his point. Prabhupada's answer was, matter does not exist. Right? That settled that. So although we make a distinction between spirit and matter, right, there is in one sense no matter, because in one sense everything is spiritual. So in the same way, although we generally make a distinction between Mahamaya and Yogamaya, in one sense, all maya is yoga maya. Yeah? Because all maya, all illusory energy is coming from Krishna. So it's yoga maya because Krishna is the source of that maya, ultimately. It is his illusory energy. Therefore, sometimes the term yoga maya may be used for all maya, including the maya that covers the transcendentalist and including the maya that covers the materialist. Life is complex, and therefore we get involved in a whole network of circumstances that ties us in deep emotional dilemmas. When we are experiencing such emotional dilemmas, we may become unhappy in life, and at that time we look for solutions, and we also look towards spiritual solutions. Having faith that there is power in spiritual practices. And it is a fact that if we go deep on the spiritual platform, that it can lift us above the anxieties that come about in a given perplexing material situation. But spiritual life is ultimately not directly going to solve our material problems. Our material problems are, they are our misfortune. We understand that this is due to us, due to some karma, some reactions of what we've done in the past. We deal with it as good as we can, but with detachment. We must simply see that, well, maybe I cannot repair this. Maybe this situation is broken, and maybe I just have to learn to become less affected by it. Maybe if I've invested so much of my time and energy trying to make something positive out of this situation, and now I maybe come to understand that it didn't work. And maybe I have to just accept that it didn't work. Then maybe this time I should start fresh. I should put my hopes elsewhere. Maybe this time I should not put my hopes in solving material situations, but maybe this time I should put my hopes in something higher than material situations, in spiritual situations. So it means really a total change in life, a total change of orientation, where we say life, it comes with inspiring moments, it comes with difficult times, it comes like that. And what can we do? We try and deal with it as good as we can, but nobody can straighten it out perfectly. No one. But ultimately, if we invest in our relationship with Krishna, nothing goes wrong there. That is the ultimate positive relationship. Relationship with the Supreme Lord is the ultimate positive relationship. So the more we enter into that positive relationship, that will give us great strength. That strength we bring back to deal with anything in this world. Then all fear, all anxiety will disappear. So therefore the best thing really is to turn towards the Lord and to very seriously try and dedicate our life to Him, because then we will get that strength that will lift us above the complexities and perplexities of life, which are, it's really too much how things can become so complicated. One looks at life and say, how did it become like this? This is amazing. Yes, it will be there. It cannot just so quickly dissolve. But the more you invest into your spiritual relationship with the Eternal Supreme Lord, the more fearless you become, the more that relationship becomes meaningful to you, the more the destructive nature of matter, right, will become secondary, because you will see that the eternal spiritual nature, and the nature of God, the nature of the soul, the nature of the spiritual world, the eternal spiritual nature cannot be destroyed. So on the spiritual plane, there's nothing to fear, because there is no doomsday. This world, it can be doomed. The soul, however, the Supreme Lord and the spiritual world are above destruction. So therefore, there is no need to fear on the spiritual plane. Therefore, one who is on the spiritual plane becomes fearless. Okay, a last point. Yeah. Is that?
Huh? Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah, well, I want to also give some room to others. Otherwise, it becomes a monologue, you know, between two people, and then you lose the group. So this is also a little difficult. So we can afterwards talk a little more if you like. Would that be all right? Ah. Well, there's still some time. Yes.
Is it possible to use your character to transform, or is it better to be first cleansing and then devote to...
Yes, it's a very... No, it's a good point. Yes, yes, we must use our character. You know, we must use our... even our temporary character, right? Although we know this is not my real character, this is not who I really am, but for now I have this character. We say the true ego, the true self, is covered by a temporary ego which comes about due to interaction of many lifetimes with matter. And we've been formed by the environment. You know, even in this life, right? You were born in a particular country and you were formed by it. And by the parents in a particular family, we're formed by it. So we're formed by all these lives. So much so that our original spiritual nature is forgotten. So now we have to start working. And we go to work with the nature that we have, with the character that we have. And we engage in Krishna's service using our character. You know, it's like... Huh? Yes. Well, I don't know if that's always true, because, of course, when we will be pure, there will be no more tension. But sometimes there is some tension also required to be pure. Because let's say somebody has a bad habit, then that person has to fight the bad habit. No? And that creates tension to fight the bad habit. So sometimes tension is necessary. But it is true that we try to follow a path which is according to our nature. You know, just like our pujari, right, is from Japan, and she has from cultural background and karma ability with flowers, and she has always, from I don't know how many years now, done the flower decorations on this altar, yeah? And that's part of nature. Right? Me, I have to sing. If I don't sing, I become sour, right? My whole life. It's always been like that. Yeah. As long as I can remember, I've been singing. Right? And really, if there's a day that goes without singing, oh boy, that's a miserable day. Yeah. So, character is there, and we can engage. Yeah. Within limits. If you say it's my character to steal, then no, sorry, there are limits, right? And well, you know, it's never nice to have some sort of emptiness, right, in ourselves. But at the same time, you cannot change overnight. No one can change. No one changes overnight. So you have tried different things and it has not been satisfying and it's left you with emptiness, well, then it will take a little while before you can put your heart into something else, which will, you know, emptiness means no hope. Yeah? You have no real hope. You know, no. See, if you're full of hope, then you don't feel empty. If you hope, yes, it's going to be wonderful, it's going to work out. If you have some belief, you have some faith, some hope that
if I go and do this, it will be really good. Then there's no question of emptiness. Then they're inspired, you see. So you have to find some hope, some faith, some belief in something. And then the emptiness will disappear. Then you have to try something. You have to be bold and try something out. If you try, you will find inspiration. We, of course, will say, try spiritual life. Since you're here today, you know. Okay. Anyway, just find out what we have. You know, obviously we have something, whatever it is, that inspires us to do this. You know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's already there, you know. But we have to reawaken it. We have to reawaken. And Krishna consciousness is already in our heart. It's completely natural to be a devotee. Actually, everyone is a devotee. There's both. No? Because, you know, there may be an intermediate step where we have to overcome some old habits. We are so much fixed in old ways that even although we want spiritual life, it just doesn't happen. So then the intermediate stage means that sometimes we may follow some discipline, yeah? Like yoga offers some discipline, meditation offers some discipline. So we also follow some discipline. We are chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. So we do that in the beginning as a discipline. Later, we do it full of inspiration. But maybe on the first day, there will be some inspiration, but then maybe on the second day, there will be not so much inspiration anymore. And then comes the doubt, you know. So the first day, yes, I felt really good. It was very inspiring. I felt like in my heart, this was it. But then after 1 week, that feeling disappeared, and I was just doing it, but it was no longer with the same inspiration. Then I got doubt. Should I carry on? The answer is no, you must carry on. Because it's like this. Our whole life we've lived in a desert. Not in a desert itself, we lived in an oasis. In the oasis there was something, but it was not fulfilling. Our oasis had something that nourished us, but it was not fulfilling. One day, we developed a desire to go to a wonderful green land where you could just be free. Right? Not just a small oasis in a hot desert, a little shelter and it's all hot around. We wanted to be in a place where we could be free and completely be natural. Then we found some knowledge of that world. We found it confirmed. Yes, it exists. You can go there. But if you go there, what you have to do? You have to leave your oasis. You have to go through the hot desert, hot dry desert, and then gradually, as you go through the journey, it will change into greener land until you get there to your destination. So in the same way, you cannot expect the spiritual life will be from a conditioned state of emptiness to the next day completely fulfilled and you always be. There is a stage in between, you know, where you have to go go through some process of purification, and then you'll be able to access that natural feeling in the heart. But sometimes you'll have moments of inspiration, and that will keep you going. Then from that you understand, yes, I must carry on with this. But you cannot expect that immediately you will be just completely inspired all the time. That would be not right. Go from the oasis through the green land to the green land we must go through the desert, inevitably.
And you were talking about the true self. And does this true self, it has its own character, and in this way we're different from each other?
Yes, yes. Our true self has an eternal character, and that will become uncovered. But it may not be what it is now. In the spiritual world, there are different relationships with Krishna. One can be in the mood of a servant of Krishna, a friend of Krishna, parent of Krishna, or loving relationship with Krishna. And all these things are different. And then within it, everyone has again his own different nature. Not so. Imagine one has the mood of a friend of Krishna. The cowherd boys, they sport with Krishna, they're friends with Krishna. But each cowherd boy has his own mood and his own relationship with Krishna individually. So we don't know what we are. Now you may be in a female body, but maybe in the spiritual world you're a cowherd boy. That's possible. Maybe not, right? But that will become clear with time. So you can, now you may have, being in that body, a particular nature that relates to it, you know. In the way you dress, in the way you like to dress, these things are all related to our present body. But maybe that will be completely different once you come to the spiritual plane. So therefore, our spiritual body is there, our spiritual nature is there, characteristics are there. We cannot really access it now. Yeah. Therefore, we first need to purify ourselves. Then it will become clear. It will emerge automatically from the heart.
I read when somebody sees the original form of the Lord and his envious nature is immediately destroyed. But in Krishna Lila and those demons don't be a good example for that.
Yeah, so those demons, when one sees the original nature of Krishna, one's envy is destroyed. So the demons that come face to face with Krishna are not able to actually see Krishna. They cannot see Krishna. Although Krishna is present before them, they cannot perceive it as such. And Krishna is covered by for them. Yeah. Therefore, they are not able to see Krishna. Just as Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says that if one chants the holy name with offenses, then one is actually not chanting Nam. Right? He makes that statement. One is not chanting the name. So if one approaches the Supreme Lord in a highly offensive mentality, demoniac mentality, even if one is face to face with the Supreme Lord, one is actually not perceiving the Lord. So this is how the demons were before the Lord and not purified from that envy. Although they were face to face, apparently face to face with the Lord, but they were not able to recognize. If, however, a person is approaching the Supreme Lord in a mood of devotion and he still has traces of material contamination in his heart, then that will be removed just immediately. That will immediately be removed in the association of the Lord. But the demon, he will remain covered. Cannot recognize Krishna.
What means to see the slight reflection of the Lord in the pure consciousness? Slight reflection of the Lord.
I think in the Bhagavatam in the 10th canto, when Krishna enters into the wrestling arena, there is the description of how different people in the arena were perceiving the Lord. So those who are materially conditioned cannot recognize the Lord. They could not recognize the Lord. Especially those who were very fixed in their own ways. So the dim reflection of the Supreme Lord, or the dim reflection of the Holy Name, it means that the preliminary influence of the Lord is present. It is, one cannot relate to the internal aspect of the Lord. One cannot relate to the Lord who is the eternal Lord of the spiritual world, and one has no ability to approach these internal pastimes of the Lord. But one can begin to relate to the external features of the Lord. The Lord as the controller, the Lord as the master of this material world, He, the supreme mystic, and all these kind of qualities. In other words, one can realize the secondary names of the Lord, but not the primary names of the Lord. Yeah. At the stage of dim reflection. Because in this world, the secondary names of the Lord, or the secondary manifestations of the Lord, according to these names, these are the dim reflections.